Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we are moving forward. And what we're doing right now in Madison's notes is we're kind of building as they've agreed. They're starting to move forward. They're talking about these things that they expect the Constitution, this new document to provide, this new government to possess, as they start folding in what they have and can they keep it from the Articles of Confederation. The process have kind of started there in this Committee of the Whole, and all of the notes that we get from Madison are literally from the Committee of the Whole, not from the subcommittees or anything like that. Every once in a while, the Committee of the Whole will hear a report from a subcommittee. And so that's when they kind of compile everything, a subcommittee. And actually, I think it's a subcommittee, but it's not the Committee of the Whole, but it is the main committee that kind of brings in all the reports and assembles the parts that came in from the subcommittee, and they present that to the Committee of the Whole, or the whole body. And that's when they say yay or nay, or they, we need to strike this, we need to change that, what have you. And then they move forward, and they take the next slice at it. And they go into more deliberation on these, other pieces of meat that they just added. They chew it up and so forth and so on. So anyway, as we were saying, and as we were going into the end of the last, before we went into Mr. Bedford, I made a comment that it was literally out there in the Constitutional Convention where the big states were going, "What's your problem, little states? What's going on here?" And this, it was literally Mr. Gunning Bedford, who's going to speak next in Madison's notes. That's why I kind of, I think that's the guy that did this. And this is exactly what he said. "I do not, gentlemen, trust you. If you possess the power, the abuse of it could not be checked. And what then would prevent you from exercising it to our destruction?" And there you go. There was no way these guys were going to give up their teeth. No way. It's not that the person themselves may, so when we read this, and it's a lot of times, and I think everybody kind of agrees, because when you call and complain because, you got bad service, or you call and complain because the product you bought was crappy, you got a problem. And so when you call and you're really infuriated, 9 times out of 10, most people take it out on the person that answers the call like they're the one that did it to you. And so, the common logical person would say, "Okay, I'm very frustrated, and I wanted to let you know that I'm not happy with what I got, but I know this is not your fault. Your job is to take my feedback and to take this call. And so if I say you did this, I don't mean you specifically. I don't mean I'm attacking you." And I believe Mr. Bedford wasn't necessarily saying he didn't trust them specifically in the convention. He didn't trust you, the big states. He didn't trust the people that would be behind it, because eventually that power would go unchecked and it would go to their destruction. I believe that's what he was saying. And because over the course of time, I mean, it's kind of like anytime you work with a group of people for a long period of time where it's just you. I mean, and as a matter of fact, you're isolated. You're not even going home to your family. This is kind of like going to boot camp. And I know Sean, being a guy that's gone to boot camp, I mean, isn't there, even at the very beginning in boot camp, Sean, is it not true that you say, there's no way we're going to come together as a unit, right?
Yeah, that was pretty much the idea when they come in smashing garbage cans to wake you up.
Yeah, but when you look at some of the people, you go, "I don't think I could, I don't think we could be, kin brethren." You know what I'm saying? Where, everybody's kind of looking at each other, because right at that point in time, we already have our biases judging each other and what have you, whether it's race, whether it's whatever those checks that we have, religious, whatever. But you're surprised at the very end when you walk and you graduate, you realize you did it as a unit and you have created a brotherly bond that, you know, it's not that it can't be broken, but you've created a brotherly bond. It may be fragile and can be broken, but that bond is a real bond, right? Does that make sense?
Correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. And I believe that's what happened with these gentlemen in the convention. And when they moved forward into the ratification debates, they were basically up there selling this. The reason why this flew like, I'll just say, X-lax through the digestive system in the small states was because it was seen as the mechanism of truly protecting them and giving them the government that they needed to actually hold the big states accountable. They saw the big states as the real problem. And when Governor Morris was making these assertions before in yesterday's reading, as we were looking at all things under the Constitutional Convention, as Governor Morris was saying that, you know, the small states, we need to take their teeth and all of this, that was only proving that Mr. Bedford right. So the point is, as we look forward, as we look at you know, what ended up happening at the end of the convention, these little states, you know, wanted and they ended up getting that amendment protection clause to keep and to secure their suffrage in the Senate, which we talk about all the time. More importantly, when they went into the ratification debates, it was a slam dunk. The only little state that actually tripped over this was New Hampshire. But when New Hampshire finally, because there was this, and if you look at the history, you look at the newspapers and everything else, the demagogues in the New Hampshire debates were literally rattling their sabers all the way to the end when they were going into the convention, where everybody felt that it was going to actually not pass because it seemed like the advantage was the anti-federalists going into the second stage of the New Hampshire ratification debates. But instead, they actually convened, they passed. I mean, they broke within 5 days, I think, they met on a Monday, and they were done signing the papers, and everybody went their way. They ratified. They were the ninth pillar or the ninth state that ratified the convention, which means that they did create a contest. They had a knockdown, drag-out fight, but they prevailed. And they were the outlier, but my point is that when it came to the small states, it was almost like this natural laxative. It just, whoop, you know, this Constitution was great. It flew right through them. Sorry for the metaphor. So apologize. But anyway, go ahead and let me see here. I think, Sean, you're up for reading what Mr. Bedford said. So let's go ahead and read that first paragraph part before the break there of what he said. Go ahead.
Mr. Bedford, Delaware, he found that what he had said as to the small states being taken by the hand had been misunderstood, and he rose to explain. He did not mean that the small states would court the aid and interposition of foreign powers. He meant that they would consider the federal compact as dissolved until it should be so by the acts of the large states. In this case, the consequence of the breach of faith on their part and the readiness of the small states to fulfill their engagements would be that foreign nations having demands on this country would find it their interest to take the small states by the hand in order to do themselves justice. This was what he meant. But no man could foresee to what extremities the small states may be driven by oppression. He observes also an apology that some allowance ought to be made for the habits of his profession in which warmth was natural and sometimes necessary. But is there not an apology in what was said by Mr. Governor Morris that the sword is to unite, by Mr. Gorham that Delaware must be annexed to Pennsylvania and New Jersey divided between Pennsylvania and New York?
Ah, so they were taking exception to what he was saying. And again, Governor Morris was one of those that led to this concept of having a very vigorous general government, and that the general government or this union would actually become a federation and the states would literally become administrative bodies. Okay, so Tammy, let's go ahead and bring up the last part of what Mr. Bedford stated.
This was what he... Oh, no, you read that part. To hear such language without emotion would be to renounce the feelings of a man and the duty of a citizen as to the propositions of the committee. The lesser states have thought it necessary to have a security somewhere. This has been thought necessary for the executive magistrate of the proposed government, who has a sort of negative on the laws, and it is not of more importance that the state should be protected than that the executive branch of the government should be protected. In order to obtain this, the smaller states have conceded as to the constitution of the first branch and as to money bills. If they be not gratified by correspondent concessions as to the second branch, it is to be supposed they will ever accede to the plan. And what will be the consequence if nothing should be done? The condition of the United States requires that something should be immediately done. It will be better that a defective plan should be adopted than that none should be recommended. He saw no reason why defects might not be supplied by meetings 10, 15, or 20 years hence.
Okay, so the point he's really, and one of the things that he comes into in talking about the magistrate, is having the magistrate kind of be the enforcer to keep the states as well as the general government in check, because, you know, he would be the one that would have the negative on the laws. And I don't know if they were still, I don't believe that there was, it was still on the table that they would negate state laws. I don't believe so. Nevertheless, because we're jumping through this. Nevertheless, he says this, because he kind of points out again that if they, the small states, be not gratified by correspondent concessions, in other words, if the bigger states don't make the concessions as to the second branch, what he's saying there is if they don't allow the state legislature to appoint their senators so that the states have that check in that second branch, is it to be supposed they will ever accede to the plan? In other words, are you really banking on the fact that we're going to agree to this plan? And then he says, and what will be the consequence if nothing should be done? The condition of the United States requires that something be done immediately. Okay, so he gets that. It will be better for a defective plan to be adopted than one not be recommended at all, because they knew going back with nothing in hand to get away from the Articles of Confederation, they were doomed. So, I mean, he was speaking really kind of pragmatic, but he was also laying it out there that, hey, it may be 15, 10, 20 years down the road where they actually may be able, as long as we can amend this properly, then there may be hope that we can fix these problems. Anyway, Mr. Ellsworth of another small state, Connecticut. Go ahead.
Mr. Ellsworth said he had not attended the proceedings of the committee, but was ready to accede to the compromise they had reported. Some compromise was necessary, and he saw none more convenient or reasonable.
Okay. Again, the compromise, again, is the Sherman or the Connecticut Compromise, where the states' legislatures would control the Senate, and the people would appoint their representatives of the states, you know, but based on population, and they would have, you know, the larger states would basically have more control over the House of Representatives, but the Senate would be equally controlled by the states, and that would be that checked. So he was basically saying, I'm on board with this. Mr. Williamson of North Carolina, go ahead.
Mr. Williamson hoped that the expressions of individuals would not be taken for the sense of their colleagues, much less of their states, which was not and could not be known. He hoped also that the meaning of those expressions would not be misconstrued or exaggerated. He did not concede that Mr. Governor Morris meant that the sword ought to be drawn against the smaller states. He only pointed out the probable consequences of anarchy in the U.S. A similar exposition ought to be given of the expressions of Mr. Gorham. He was ready to hear the report discussed, but thought the propositions contained in it the most objectionable of any he had heard yet heard.
Okay, so they're basically kind of, all right, obviously this is a real bone of contention. Mr. Patterson of New Jersey, go ahead, Tammy, and go ahead and read the Mr. Gary of Massachusetts. Technically, I'd like to point out, Massachusetts was a small state, size-wise. It was just heavily populated. So go ahead and give us Mr. Patterson first.
Right. Okay, Mr. Patterson said that he had, when the report was agreed to in the
committee,
In the committee reserved himself the right of freely discussing it. He acknowledged that the warmth complained of was improper, but he thought the sword and the gallows He thought the sword and the gallows as little calculated to produce conviction. He complained of the manner in which Mr. Morris, no, I don't know who the M, this
probably
one
Madison,
is.
Mr. Madison
and Mr. Governor Morris had treated the small states.
Okay. All right, so go ahead.
Massachusetts. Uh-huh. Hmm? Though he had assented to the report in the committee, he had very material objections to it. We were, however, in a particular situation. We were neither the same nation nor different nations. We ought not, therefore, to pursue the one or the other of these ideas too closely. If no compromise should take place, that will be the consequence. A secession, he foresaw, would take place, for some gentlemen seemed decided on it. Two different plans will be proposed, and the result no man could foresee. If we do not come to some agreement among ourselves, some foreign sword will probably do the work for us.
Okay, so it seems to me like everything that there's right here they're dealing with is all agreeing that they needed to move forward. All were agreeing that they were all different countries. I mean, they all understood that there was no two states that were really alike. There were these different idiosyncrasies that really made them different, and that they needed to come together, and this compromise. So I think at this point, I don't know if there's actually a formal adoption, because we don't go through this, everything said, all the votes cast and so forth. But we try to cover these heavy comments that really help us see what they were struggling with. And this compromise, the Sherman-Connecticut Compromise, was a huge pitch because, in a way, it was giving Madison in his plan of creating this three-branch government an option of preserving the representation of the people based on population, as long as he was willing to concede that the Senate, where they would be checks on each other, then the Senate itself would be able to preserve the sovereignty of the states. To me, and as we look at this, folks, I don't think anybody in today's reference would even bat an eye in understanding why moving forward with this compromise was the no-brainer. I mean, problematically, they could always come up with these potential theoretical problems. But pragmatically, this was the way to go. So Mr. Mason then opines, and go ahead with this, if you would, Sean.
Mr. Mason of Virginia, the report was meant not as specific propositions to be adopted, but merely as a general ground of accommodation. There must be some accommodation on this point, or we shall make little further progress in the work. Accommodation was the object of the House in the appointment of the committee, and of the committee in the report they had made. And however liable the report might be to objections, he thought it preferable to an appeal to the world by the different sides, as he had been talked of by some gentlemen. It could not be more inconvenient to any gentleman to remain absent from his private affairs than it was for him. But he would bury his bones in this city rather than expose his country to the consequences of a dissolution of the convention without anything being done.
Go ahead, keep going.
The first proposition in the report for fixing the representation in the first branch, one member for every 40,000 inhabitants being taken up.
Okay, so now that's kind of a procedural, this is the way they're going to discuss. And actually, this is where apportionment becomes the key thing. So Tammy, and this is kind of probably long, but Tammy, go ahead and read the yellow text, and I'll have Sean read the green text of Governor Morris. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Governor Morris objected to that scale of apportionment. He thought property ought to be taken into the estate as well as the number of inhabitants. Life and liberty were generally said to be of more value than property. An accurate view of the matter would nevertheless prove that the property was the main object of society. The savage state was more favorable to liberty than the civilized, and sufficiently so to life. It was preferred by all men who had not acquired a taste for property. It was only renounced for the sake of property which could only be secured by the restraints of regular government. These ideas might appear to some new, but they were nevertheless just. If property, then, was the main object of government, certainly it ought to be one measure of the influence due to those who were to be affected by the government. He looked forward also to that range of new states which would soon be formed in the West.
Okay, Sean, now go ahead and read this.
He thought the rule of representation ought to be so fixed as to secure the Atlantic states a prevalence in the national councils. The new states will know less of the public interest than these, will have an interest in many respects different. In particular, will be little scrupulous of involving the community in wars, the burden and operations of which would fall chiefly on the maritime states. Provision ought therefore to be made to prevent the maritime states from being hereafter outvoted by them. He thought this might be easily done by irrevocably fixing the number of representatives which the Atlantic states should respectively have and the number which each new state will have. This would not be unjust, as the Western settlers would previously know the conditions on which they were to possess their lands. It would be politic, as would recommend the plan to the present as well as future interests of the states, which must decide the fate of it.
Okay, so right there, ba-doom, here it is. We're going to create an advantage for the Atlantic states because we believe we need to be protected. We need to have control. What, you know, and as this goes through, however they justify it, this is where we really see the light of day of how the Atlantic states, the water states, were there. What states had been formed that really didn't have any access to the Atlantic at this point in time?
I can't think of any.
So when one looks, Pennsylvania doesn't touch seawater, right?
Oh, okay.
But it does have the Potomac. And it does have, you know, that major river access to the Potomac. So they wanted to, and I think, you know, Governor Morris, because he's from Pennsylvania. And let me ask you this. Does it help for me to include the state next to the name? Because those were added, obviously, because when you read Madison's text, it just says name. So that this way you know who and where they're coming from. But here he was basically, you know, making the presumption that Pennsylvania was an Atlantic state. He could have easily been, as they move forward, go, yeah, you know, this is a really good idea, and then have it bite him by saying, you know, we don't consider you, Pennsylvania, to be an Atlantic state. I mean, you only have one river access. So,
yeah.
So anyway, but here it's out of the mouths of babes. Here we have it. We now see how, you know, they wanted to have an advantage and have all of the other states joining the Union to be less or not have equal footing and to be subjugated to these controlling states. I'll pick this up when we come back from the break, because this could have easily gone down the really a bad path. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
All right, so with further knowledge and actually being kind of going into today, Tammy told us that she was going to leave. I had thought wiser of not going down the path of, you know, saying, well, the caldera went off in Wyoming and Tammy's gone now. Anyway, so forgive me. I mean, as my wife says, I'm the only one that thinks I'm funny. But that being said, we ended up having to lose Tammy on some personal appointments and so forth. But let me just say this, because going into the break, this could have easily gone down the wrong path, because what they would have saw in looking at the Western lands, and they would have said, hey, you know what, we really need to plan for this. We need to get it right first time in the Constitution. What they probably would have implemented would have been a formula that always maintained a majority control of these original 13 or 12 states, because Pennsylvania could have been cited out. And these 12 states would always be a majority in both houses, that they were going to have a majority control in both the Senate as well as the House of Representatives, because they did not want to have these new states joining to take away their strategic advantages and so forth. And they thought that these were good ideas. They literally thought that these were good ideas. And, oh, by the way, these ideas were quickly latched onto by whom? By the Southern gentleman in the room. And ergo, Mr. Rutledge jumped up, and this is what he said. Go ahead, Sean.
Mr. Rutledge of South Carolina, the gentleman last up had spoken some of his sentiments precisely. Property was certainly the principal object of society. If numbers should be made the rule of representation, the Atlantic states will be subjected to the Western.
Let me ask you this real quick. Let me ask you this, because we haven't gotten there. When he's talking property, what do you think he's bringing to the table when it comes to property?
Slaves.
Yeah, but when Governor Morris was talking about property, what do you think he was bringing to the table?
Land.
Land. Ha, ha, ha. So
access to the ocean.
There you go. So it was about land. And now these guys, the Southern states, oh, well, we do believe it's about property. Yeah, we like this idea. And and this is where they were going to start building their justification that slaves are property and it's more valuable property, obviously, to them. And when they actually look at the value of property in the states at this point in time, everybody in the room knows that the Southern states' land, that these plantations, that land is far exceeds the value of the regular, you know, little crop farmers and everything else up north. The more productive your land is, the greater the value. And that's how they wanted to come in with that superiority. And this is when the South actually started pitching this. And this is when we start going, it really starts going sideways to where the Southern states say, hey, we're going to pay for your wars and all that type of stuff. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. You were going to say something.
No, it's probably getting ahead of us too. I was just going to say, it seems kind of ironic that They wanted representation apportioned by people that they weren't going to give representation to.
Right. And interestingly enough, the progressives have convinced the young generations that you know, the fact that the three-fifths rule to basically hurt the institution of slavery, they twisted it. People today think the three-fifths rule was actually inhumane when the whole objective was to hurt the institution of slavery, not to hurt the individuals. They were basically calling the Southern states out for hypocrites, and they weren't going to get full credit for, you know, having their bread buttered on every side. Okay, well, we're making a concession that will allow you to have some credit, but we're not going to give you full apportionment. No way. And so that three-fifths rule, because every time we bring up slavery, folks, when you really look at it, the larger the plantation is, the more slaves they need. Sure, but it keeps other people as well, because when you look at, you know, the small crops, or I should say the small plantations down in Georgia were 10 acres square. Or I think it was just 10 acres. And these were 100 acres. These in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, most indentured servants received 100 acres. So they started much bigger. And so when you look at the value per acre and how many people per acre, in Georgia, the population in 100 acres was far denser, and there were more white folk because it was broken into smaller, I'll just say these smaller little plantations. And up north, there was a higher concentration, less white folk, but even less people occupying that land. Because, you know, you don't need to have one person per plant. It's not one person per acre either. It's based on, you know, the commitment of labor to the amount of land that one person can do. And technically, one person can easily nurture and develop 10 acres on their own. It's just more you have, and so these plantations started getting huge. Not just hundreds and thousands of acres, where they were these huge. I mean, look, do you know how big, I'm sure you could look it up, how big was Mount Vernon Estates? That was the largest plantation, I think, in America. And it was an amalgamation of other plantations all formed as a part of Washington's Mount Vernon Estate. It was huge. George Washington probably was the richest man in America when he was president, based on his assets, resources, his balance sheet. So anyway, as we kind of look, the southern states were going to be capped. I mean, once they go from the Atlantic Ocean out and fill every inch of that state with plantations, if it is possible. Now, they have mountains and so forth where you just can't do it. And that land is, you know, maybe timber or what have you, but the dense population is not going to be there either. There is no place in the southern states for a dense population, except for maybe the ports where there's the exchange, where they're not plantations, though. Plantations reduce population per capita or per square mile. It does. It just reduces it. So these men knew this, and they knew that the northern states, without slavery, would quickly advance to having a higher population. They would have more representation. And if states were joining the Union that were not slave states, they would actually be able to, you know, get the states to all agree that they've got to get rid of slavery. That was the calculation. That's what we'll find in the ratification debates, exactly how it was presented. So the whole point is, because I get into this, and I want to make sure every time we talk about the three-fifths rule, you see the big picture. That was a calculation to end the institution. This was not a calculation because people were black that they thought that they were less. Not at all. These were actually political and mathematical calculations that were being placed on the table for compromise, so that there was a level of political power being protected or afforded, and the calculations were, as things move forward, the power would shift. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. All right. And I, you know, I appreciate that. And I say that a lot because I'm not sure if the way I've articulated it made sense. Because, you know, did I connect all the dots to go, okay, I get it, GR. The three-fifths right. rule was not a racist move that we've been taught. Wow.
Right. No, I understand exactly what you're talking about and how it's been manipulated.
Yes.
You know, because it's easy to twist things around because once you hit people in that emotional, especially Christians, with, you know, everybody, if they have any morals whatsoever, believes that slavery is hard and evil.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, and when you look at that and they can twist it easily because you are automatically have that response
sure.
to slavery as an institution.
Right. Great. Thank you. All right. Because I think it's really important every time it comes up. So this is why GR always reiterates this. Okay. So let's go ahead and move forward then with what he says now. Go ahead.
Okay. He moved that the first proposition in the report be postponed in order to take up the following, that the suffrages of the several states be regulated and proportioned according to the sums to be paid towards the general revenue by the inhabitants of each state respectively, that an apportionment of suffrages according to the ratio aforesaid shall be made and regulated at the end of blank years from the first meeting of the legislature of the U.S., and at the end of every blank years, but that for the present and until the period above mentioned, the suffrages shall be for New Hampshire, blank, Massachusetts, blank, etc.
Okay, so he's laying this out to kind of create the baseline. Now, Mr. Mason comes in, and I don't think, you know, he may know what's going on regarding, you know, the setup for the slavery, but what does Mr. Mason say?
Colonel Mason said the case of new states was not unnoticed in the committee, but it was thought, and he was himself decidedly of opinion, that if they made a part of the Union, they ought to be subject to no unfavorable discriminations. Obvious considerations required it.
Yes. Okay, so what were those obvious considerations? I mean, it's subjective, but the obvious considerations is, didn't we just fight a revolution against a nation that thought that they were superior to us?
And didn't the guys who fought and bled and died, did they ask them if they had property before they asked them to come pick up a weapon?
Yeah, many, as a matter of fact, it got so desperate because they weren't getting the support. I think I kind of went through the numbers before, but I'll just do this at a real high level. They looked at America being divided in thirds. At the time of the Declaration of Independence moving forward, they thought 40%, something around 30-some percent, were in favor, thirds. 30-some percent were in favor of the revolution. 30-some percent were in favor of letting Britain do what they needed to do. And the other 30% were indifferent. And out
yeah,
of that,
I saw that yesterday, actually.
And out of that one third of in favor of the revolution, a very small percentage out of the whole. And when you look at the inhabitants of the whole, not a percentage of the third, but the inhabitants of the whole, they felt it came to about 10%. So when you look at 10% of the nation, that would have been almost a third of the third. To try to keep the fractions right. So a third of the third really did support the combat, the, you know, the use of deadly force and fighting the revolution, and I mean supported it. In other words, they supported it in different ways, i.e. they were giving their crops, they were donating, they all were in one way or the other, maybe they couldn't fight, what have you, but they were supporting it actively. And then out of that, there was probably 7% that were directly supporting it. In other words, in governing, in the financing, in the emissaries, the accounting, you know, the working of the administration of prosecuting the war with Continental Congress and so forth, about 7% of the population was absolutely involved in the revolution, not actively supporting, but involved. And then the fighters, the ground combats, came out to basically I think it was something like 3%. But it wasn't 3% of the freemen. It was 3% of the slaves and freemen when they were counting these numbers. And this is the irony here. They ended up having to do a massive recruiting into the southern states to basically make an appeal to the slaves to say, if you would take up arms to secure our freedom, you will be free as well. And so this was a great way of purging the slavery ranks of the South. And so the South wasn't happy with it, but they knew that it was either us or them. And so they ended up having to, you know, surrender their control and their property. And they weren't happy about that. And so they were looking and looking and looking, and they were using the slave trade at this point and doing everything they possibly could to rebuild their institution of slavery. So just to lay the numbers out there, it wasn't like 50% of Washington's troops, but the entire 3% of the population that was actually carrying guns and in service at some point in time during the Revolutionary War included those slaves. It wasn't 3% of white folk, if that makes sense. So just to kind of help everybody see this. Now, so in Mason, what he's saying is, hey, hold on here. I'm not in favor of this at all. They ought to, and they ought to be subject to these new states to no unfavorable discriminations, because if not, we're basically creating a powder keg that we will not want to deal with the reckoning thereof. But he doesn't say that there. And what does Mr. Randolph say? It's pretty quick here.
Mr. Randolph concurred with Colonel Mason.
Okay, so two quick dissenters. Out of what state? Virginia. I don't even put it here, but that's because most people should know this. But and you notice that the states I kind of drop out. So Randolph concurs with this. So the committee is called by the secretary on the question on Mr. Rutledge's motion. How many states wanted to move forward with what he was presenting? Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. In other words, everybody was rejecting it. This had nothing to do with admitting new states into the Union. This had everything to do with they knew where he was going. And when you look at the states, only South Carolina said yay.
They must have voted first.
Yeah, and Georgia wasn't on the floor. In other words, so they didn't cast a vote. They weren't there. They may have been able to support it, but for the most part, even North Carolina voted against it at this point in time. Because I don't think that the three southern states were on the same sheet at this point in time. This door just finally opened, okay? So Friday, July 6th, in the convention, Mr. Governor Morris then basically goes on, and what does he say? Go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris moved to commit. So much of the report as relates to I member for every 440,000 inhabitants.
One member.
Inhabitants.
Yeah, one member.
Oh, one member. Okay. I member. Yeah. I was wondering why it sounded so crazy. Okay. One member for every 40,000 inhabitants. His view was that they might absolutely fix the number for each state in the first instance, leaving the legislature at liberty to provide for changes in the relative importance of the states and for the case of new states.
Okay. So in other words, each state was going to be getting this, and they were caveating and deducting. Governor Morris was kind of, I don't know if he was sidestepping it, but he just said, let's take it 40,000 for every one representative. Okay, so Mr. Wilson seconded the motion, but with a view of leaving the committee under no implied shackles. You know, go ahead and figure out what you want to do. Mr. Gorm, go ahead.
Apprehended great inconveniency from fixing directly the number of representatives to be allowed to each state. He thought the number of inhabitants the true guide, though perhaps some departure might be expedient from the full proportion. The states also would vary in their relative extent by separations of parts of the largest states. A part of Virginia is now on the point of a separation. In the province of Maine, a convention is at this time deliberating on a separation from Massachusetts. In such events, the number of representatives ought certainly to be reduced. He hoped to see all the states made small by proper divisions, instead of their becoming formidable as was apprehended to the small states. He conceived that let the general government be modified as it might, there would be a constant tendency in the state governments to encroach upon it. It was of importance, therefore, that the extent of the state should be reduced as much and as fast as possible. The stronger the government shall be made in the first instance, the more easily will these divisions be effected, as it will be of less consequence in the opinion of the states, whether they be of great or small extent.
Okay, so up above in the beginning of, or not the beginning, but kind of the first part of what he was talking about, I would just want to highlight this. The states also would vary in their relative extent by separations of parts of the large states. In other words, he saw that large states were getting ready to divide, that the people didn't want to necessarily be a part of that large state. They were ready to kind of create their own state. And as a matter of fact, in such case, he pointed out, a part of Virginia is now a point of separation, which is Kentucky. And in the province of Maine, M-A-Y-N-E, a convention is at this time deliberating on a separation from Massachusetts. Here's the question, as you read this, when did Maine join the Union?
I don't know.
Most people don't. Do you know the background of the Missouri Compromise?
No, sir.
Maine was finally ready to join the Union, and Missouri was chomping at the bit to join the Union. And so what they did was they wanted, and both Maine and Missouri were going to join everybody says that Missouri was going to join as a slave state. And they said, okay, that's fine, but we need to make sure moving forward that all states, you know, that join, you know, certain states are slave states and certain states aren't. But here's the whole point. Maine was ready at this point. They already saw Maine. What took Maine 30 years to get there? Do you see my point? That was 1820. Why did they hold on to Maine? And why didn't Maine just go ahead and break forward? Actually, what ended up happening was Vermont broke away from New Hampshire. That was the first state that broke away. Then it was Connecticut, and then it was Tennessee from North Carolina. And so as all of these states started doing this, and keep in mind, the admission of new states was controlled by Congress. They basically made sure that the state was in compliance to the law, in compliance to the currency, contract, those types of things, as well as had, you know, the requisite amount of people, blah, blah, blah. They had no ability to dictate how they were to govern, how to set up their justice system. However they wanted to move forward was up to them. 30 years later, it changed. And it changed dramatically in 30 years, but 26 years later with Indiana, it started changing. And every state that joined the Union afterwards was brought into the Union with all sorts of unconstitutional assertions by the federal government. This is why I say, and when I deal with people, oh, well, you know, we got a problem with this. All constitutions and all states that joined the Union, with Indiana and on, 1816 and on, you need to really re-examine your constitutions and determine whether, you know, you wanted to maintain or you want to keep those things that the federal government induced or basically inflicted you with, because they had no authority to do it. And this demands that all states literally re-examine, because technically, they need to take their land back. They need to take their full sovereignty back, because it was theirs. It was never the federal government's to take it. And this really silences all of these guys about, oh, well, the federal government is able to do these things. They didn't have the authority. This really separates the wheat from the chaff. Anybody out there that says all of this stuff is legitimate and you need to leave the Union, you need to separate yourself and become a sovereign citizen, a state national, because of this legitimacy of the and this, you know, atrocity, they're accepting these unconstitutional violations, and they're basically looking at these violations as legitimate. which is absolutely it's a lie. They're embracing the lie, and they're being very divisive and subversive, because the more people they convince to surrender their citizenship, the less people we have here to do the fighting. Hopefully that makes sense as well. So
it absolutely does.
Okay, so Mr. Gary now opines. So let's go ahead and let's cover that.
Mr. Gary did not think with his colleague that the large states ought to be cut up. This policy had been inculcated by the middling and smaller states, ungenerously and contrary to the spirit of the Confederation. Ambitious men will act to solicit needless divisions till the states be reduced to the size of counties. If this policy should still actuate the small states, the large ones could not confederate safely with them, but would be obliged to insult their safety by confederating only with one another. He favored the commitment and thought that representation ought to be in the combined ratio of numbers of inhabitants and of wealth, and not of either singly.
Okay, so in other words, he's making a really interesting point. He's basically saying, hey, these states that have property, that, you know, have inhabitants, the only reason that they're going to be admitted into the Union was because of the meddling of the smaller and the middle states. In other words, there were, at this point in time, I think that there were probably four or five states that were big that everybody wanted to cut up. And Massachusetts, having been one of the very few, and there, its territory was limited. The only territory it really had was Maine. Vermont was New Hampshire. Actually, there was a dispute between Vermont being New Hampshire and or New York. Both of those states were claiming that territory is theirs. And I think this is when New Hampshire wanted to make sure they freed the inhabitants in that. That's why they were the first into the gate to go, you guys need to go and, you know, request to be admitted as a state for Vermont. Because at that point, I don't think, so if you think about it, what would happen if Vermont didn't, or New Hampshire didn't do that, and the state legislature, the people of Vermont didn't go to New Hampshire and say, can we be admitted as a state? And they pass that, and that goes to Congress. That means that they opened the door to letting them be a state when it didn't settle the dispute whether it was New York or New Hampshire's. Does that make sense? Because New York wasn't willing to give up that little land. It was going to be and maintained as a part of the state of New York. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so in other words, New Hampshire made a power play to secure the freedom and liberty of the good people of Vermont so that they could have their own separate state and have their own sovereignty, where New York wasn't going to be playing that. Now, we've covered quite a bit, but when we come back in our next episode, we're going to dive even more into the admission of states and this concept of property. This is kind of a long dialogue, but it's worth every minute. And you need, folks, I hope you're reading along with us as we go, because you get so much more out of it. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.